And with the animal cell, we talked about a number of structures. We talked about the nucleus, the nucleolus, the DNA inside of the nucleus, the ER and how it functions. And we ended up, as we were talking about the endoplasmic reticulum, we said that as soon as the protein is produced, it pushes against the sidewall of the ER, and the protein expands that wall, and eventually a piece of the plasma membrane of the ER surrounds the protein, and the protein is released in a transport vesicle. So now in our factory, if we use our factory analogy, in this factory we've completed the protein now, we've completed the product. So in a normal factory, what's kind of the next step in the factory?
Sell it.
Okay, before you even sell it. Okay, you have to package it for one. What else? You do have to transport it. But you also have to check for quality, right? Because you don't want bad products going out. Does that make sense? So the next area of the cell that we're going to talk about, the next organelle, is what we call the Golgi apparatus or the Golgi complex. And basically what the Golgi is it's a quality control packaging center of the cell. This is where we check the proteins, or where the proteins are checked to see if they are good or see if they have any problems, and also where the protein is packaged and then sent to where it needs to be, whether that's in or out of the cell. Okay. So if we take a close look at the Golgi, what the Golgi looks like is, it looks like a bunch of pita bread that's stacked on top of one another. Okay, so it's hollow on the inside. Now remember, what surrounds the Golgi here? What's this stuff? Plasma membrane, right? Phospholipid bilayer. The transport vesicle coming from the ER, what surrounds it? Yeah, the same thing. Phospholipid bilayer or plasma membrane. So what happens is this transport vesicle comes from the ER. The two plasma membranes, both that from the transport vesicle and from the Golgi complex, fuse together, and that's how the protein gets into the Golgi complex. Inside of the Golgi, then, a number of things can happen. The first thing that the Golgi does is it's basically a quality control center. The Golgi may be able to fix minor problems with the protein. That's rare. What it can do if the protein's not made properly is it can send the protein to the recycler, okay? Because the cell doesn't want to send out a bad product, just like any factory doesn't want to send out a bad product, okay? And then eventually what happens is that protein pushes against the plasma membrane on the other side of the Golgi here, very similar to what we talked about with the ER, and as that protein pushes on that plasma membrane, it stretches out again, and a piece of it plops off, and the protein then is sent where it needs to go in, again, what we call a transport vesicle. Okay. Any questions about the Golgi?
So isn't it ribosomes still that turn into the protein? Or?
No. The ribosomes have already been used. Remember, the ribosomes are the tools that are used to make the protein. Okay. So we've already used the tool on the ER, so they're basically... we're done using that tool. Okay?
Okay, is that at the last stage we talked about?
Mm-hmm. Yep, on the ER.
Where is it again? Where
the
is it?
The ribosomes are found on the ER.
No, they're Golgi complex.
It can be anywhere in the cell. If we look at this picture, it just shows it right here. You can tell the difference between the ER and the Golgi by looking at them, because the Golgi is more uniform in shape. It's also, again, it looks like a bunch of pita bread stacked on top of one another, whereas the endoplasmic reticulum looks a lot more like tubes or tunnels. Okay. Any questions about the Golgi complex? The next organelle that we want to talk about in the cell is shown right here. This is what we call a lysosome. Okay, and basically what the lysosome is it's the garbage or recycler of the cell. So let's say, for example, a protein's produced, it's checked in the Golgi determines that protein is made improperly. What it's going to do is it's going to send that protein to the lysosome. Now what happens in the lysosome is the lysosome either kind of stores it as waste, or in some cases it can recycle the components of that protein. Okay? So it can recycle. And then the components or the amino acids can then be reused, just like a recycling factory that, you know, might recycle paper or glass or something. Okay. Any questions? Now in this cell, it actually only shows, in this picture, it only shows one lysosome. Some cells have many lysosomes in them because they have to not only deal with waste from within the cell, but also waste that is surrounding the cell. For example, in our body, we have a structure called the liver. The liver is the biggest organ in our body. And the function of our liver is to filter waste out of the blood and out of our body. So your liver kind of deals a lot with waste products. And so if you were to look at a cell from a liver, it would just be filled with lysosomes. Does that make sense? And the reason why, because it not only has to deal with internal waste, but also external waste. So there may be more than one lysosome in a cell. There may be many lysosomes, depending on what type of a cell we're talking about. Okay? Any questions? Okay, so the lysosomes are the recycling garbage centers of the cell. All right? The last major organelle or structure that we want to talk about in the animal cell is this one right here. There's one here, and one shown up here. Okay. And again, with this organelle, there may be one or hundreds or sometimes even thousands of them within a single cell. This particular organelle is called the mitochondrion. Okay. Now the mitochondrion, its basic function is it's the power plant for the cell. Right, it's the power plant. So with any factory, if we had our car factory that we've been using as an analogy, in order to have the car factory up and running, you have to have some sort of power, right? Okay, electricity or something. Same thing is true with the cell. In order to allow the cell to function, the cell needs to have power or energy in order to function. The power or energy that the cell uses is adenosine triphosphate, or ATP. And that is what is produced in the mitochondria. A little bit later on in the semester, we're going to talk about specifically how ATP is produced in the mitochondria through a process called respiration. But for right now, just kind of think of the mitochondrion as the power plant of the cell. Okay? Any questions so far? If we take a close-up look at the mitochondrion, the mitochondrion is quite a bit different in the way that it looks and the way that it functions in relationship to other cells. The first thing that's very different about the mitochondrion is it has two plasma membranes. It has an outer membrane that you can see drawn here, and then it has an inner membrane, but this inner membrane is highly folded. Okay, so it's folded up in here, forming what we call a matrix. Do all of you know what a matrix is? It's kind of a maze, I guess you could say, all right? Something with folds. And so whenever, if I show you a picture, for example, on the test of a mitochondrion, you can easily tell that it's a mitochondrion because you will see this highly folded inner membrane inside of the structure, okay? What it reminds me of is, when I look at the matrix, is it reminds me of slot canyons in southern Utah. Maybe that's because I like to do that kind of stuff. But that's what it reminds me of. Okay? And again, power that is needed to run the cell is going to be produced in the mitochondrion. Okay? Are there any questions? Another major difference between mitochondrion and other organelles is that mitochondrion has its own DNA. Okay, it has its own DNA. Therefore, the only way that we can get new mitochondrion is by division of pre-existing mitochondria. All right? So let's say, for example, if a cell divided, this is hypothetical and it doesn't really happen, but just to kind of illustrate the point here, let's say we only have one mitochondrion in this cell, through our highly folded inner membrane. Okay? If this cell were to divide right here, what would happen is this cell would actually die. And the reason it would die is because it would not have any energy making structure in it. Okay, it can't just produce mitochondria. On the other hand, if a cell doesn't have any ER in it, or if it doesn't have any Golgi, it can actually produce more Golgi or more ER, because all it is essentially plasma membrane. Okay, but the mitochondrion, it has plasma membrane, but it also has its own DNA. Any questions about that? It's kind of interesting. They've done some studies on the human population in the world, and they believe that we all came from one of six original females. Did you know that? They call them six original mothers of Earth. And the where we get that idea from is you can actually look at your mitochondrial DNA, and you have the same mitochondrial DNA as your mother. Okay, when a sperm cell fuses to an ovum, the cell that brings the mitochondria with it, essentially, is the ovum. And so your mitochondrial DNA are exactly like your mother's mitochondrial DNA. Okay? So they've tested, you know, a random sample of people throughout the world, and they found six different mothers that everybody in the world you think has come from. Okay? And you can actually find out which of the six mothers you came from. You just need to send your DNA to a lab in England, and they'll do that mitochondrial DNA testing and send you your results for about $150. Okay. So if you're interested, you can find out. So, any questions about mitochondria? So what type of a cell, for example, this is just another picture of a mitochondrion here, what type of cell, for example, would have a lot more mitochondrion than maybe any other cell in our body? Think about that. What's mitochondrion used for?
Energy.
To produce energy. Which types of cells in our body need the most energy?
Muscles.
Yeah, muscles. So muscle cells would have hundreds, sometimes thousands of mitochondrion per cell. Does that make sense to everybody? So the only way to get new mitochondria in those is by division of pre-existing mitochondria. Any questions so far? Okay, the last thing that we want to talk about in the cell is kind of everything else here. We see some little stick-like structures. The stuff that's just in yellow here, or orange, whichever color it is, kind of yellowish-orange, throughout the cell. We've talked about most of the major organelles, and now we just want to talk about kind of everything else. The everything else is called the cytoplasm, okay? And the cytoplasm basically has two parts to it. It has what we call the cytosol and the cytoskeleton. Okay. The cytosol is the liquid part of the cell. It's generally made up of a large component of the cytosol is water. There can be other molecules as well in the cytosol, but it's mainly water. So when we draw a picture of the cell, let me back up one, it's kind of hard to show that there's water here, but there's something in the cell here, and it's essentially water and other liquid types of molecules, and that's what we call the cytosol. All right? The second part of the cytoplasm is what we call the cytoskeleton. The cytoskeleton does exactly what it sounds like. It makes up the skeletal structure of the cell. And the cytoskeleton is basically made up of proteins. There are three different types of proteins that make up the cytoskeleton. There's what we call microfilaments. On this slide here, it shows that it is an actin filament. Actin filaments are a specific type of microfilaments. So microfilaments, intermediate filaments, and microtubules. Okay, those are the three components that make up the skeletal structure of the cell. The largest of these three types of proteins are what we call microtubules. Intermediate in size, you can probably guess, are the intermediate filaments, right? And the smallest in terms of size are what we call the microfilaments, right? Now, each of them have a particular function in the skeletal structure of the cell. The first that we're going to talk about is the microtubule. Okay. The basic function of microtubules in the cell is they provide structural support for the cell. All right? Now, what is structural support?
It's what keeps it shaped so that we might bend forward.
Okay, it keeps it shaped. So if you think about building a house or a middle building or something, the very first thing that they put up are the structural supports. Okay, so the structural supports basically give the house or the building shape. So that would be like the framing. Does that make sense to everybody? That would be the structural support of the house, would be the frame. Okay. So the microtubules are kind of like the frame of the cell. All right. Any questions? Now, in addition, microtubules can be used for another purpose, and that is to produce some structures that are called flagella. And cilia. Okay. Flagella and cilia are structures that are found on the outside, typically, of the cell, and they are used for one of two purposes. That is either to move the cell from point A to point B, or to move something past the cell. Okay, and they both can function in either capacity. When we look at the structure of a cilium or a flagellum, what we find is that the structure is made up of microtubules. You can see this series of microtubules around this cross-section of a flagellum here. Okay. So basically, a flagellum and cilia are made up of microtubules. Now, there are two differences, major differences between cilia and flagellum. First of all, flagellum are usually relatively long in relationship to the size of the cell, whereas cilia are actually really short in relationship to the size of the cell. Okay. The second major difference is that in most cells only have one, maybe two flagellum at the most. Where if a cell has cilia on it, it usually has hundreds or thousands of cilia. Okay, so it just kind of covers the entire cell. Right? Any questions? Now, we talked about two functions of the cilia and flagellum. That's either to move the cell or to have something move past the cell. And so, let me give you a couple of examples of how that occurs. When you think of a flagellated cell, most of you think of what type of a cell? Do any of you know of a cell that has flagellum on it?
Sperm.
Yeah, exactly, right? So sperm have a flagellum. And the function of that flagellum is to move the sperm from point A to point B, right? And actually they move long, long distances, believe it or not, in relationship to the size of the sperm. But let's take humans for example. Sperm is deposited in the vagina. In order for fertilization to occur, that sperm has to swim from the vagina up through the cervix, through the uterus, up the fallopian tubes, where fertilization is going to occur, right? And so that flagellum helps propel that sperm from the vagina to the fallopian tubes where fertilization is going to occur, right? Okay. And so the flagellum, in that case, moves the cell from point A to point B. Now, there are also other cells in which the flagellum is used to move substances past the cell, and we'll actually talk about some examples of that later on in the semester. Let me give you an example of cilia. Now, cilia can be used for either function. I'm going to give you one example of cilia, of where the cilia moves something past the cell instead of moving the cell itself. Okay. In your respiratory system, where you breathe, the cells that line the respiratory system are just covered with cilia. Okay. Now, one of the things that we produce in our respiratory system is we produce kind of a mucusy-like substance. And that mucusy-like substance is used to catch foreign particles that go down into the respiratory tract, right? So, I don't know if any of you smoke or want to admit it, but if you smoke or if you have a father that works in a coal mine, you ever notice they're constantly spitting up black logies? You ever notice that? Why is that?
It's part of it being cut.
Yeah, or if you work in a dusty environment, you'll do the same type of thing. It may not be black logies, but it's junk that's spit up. And the reason why is on these cells lining the respiratory tract, you have this mucus that catches foreign particles, whatever they are, smoke, dust, whatever, okay? And then also on the in your the cells that line your respiratory tract, you, their cells are ciliated. So the cilia are constantly beating, and they're beating upward. And so it pushes that mucus with all that junk up the respiratory tract and eventually out of the respiratory tract and into our mouth. Okay? Now all of us have this happen to some extent, but it's more extensive in people who work in polluted environments or pollute their own environment, right? Okay. So the cells are constantly beating, and it pushes this mucus with all the junk up into our throat, essentially. Does that make sense to everybody? So that's what a logi is. I don't know why you get logies. And if you swallow logies, in my mind, that's pretty darn gross. Because what you're swallowing is you're swallowing junk that's not supposed to be in your respiratory tract, right? In my mind, you got to spit them out and get that junk out of your body, okay? So, any questions about ciliary flagellum? Okay, so microtubules, again, just to review, are used for the to give the cell structural support, but they can also be used in mobility structures such as cilia and flagellum. The intermediate filaments, actually, their job in the cell is to give the cell mechanical strength. Okay, who knows what mechanical strength is? Engineers? You ever heard of a mechanical engineer? Okay. What they do is they help to design structures, but what they're most interested in is to prevent those structures from twisting or torquing. Okay. So basically what the intermediate cells or intermediate filaments do, they prevent the cell from twisting apart or from torquing. Okay. Now if we use an analogy of a building, mechanical strength is also inserted into a building. If you've ever seen a metal building being put up, or even houses, right after they put up the frame, they'll put these crossbars that kind of go kitty-cornered in the wall. Have you ever seen those before? You wondered why they put them there? That's to give the building mechanical strength. When I was growing up, one of the things that I did all summer long was build metal buildings all summer. And you can build a huge metal building as big as this science building. And if it doesn't have mechanical strength, you can stand on the corner of the building and just shake it, and the whole building will torque back and forth. Have you ever done that before with like houses or something? The minute you put those crossbars in or that mechanical strength, it prevents it from twisting or torquing. Okay. Now, when you put the siding on a house, then that actually gives it mechanical strength. But before you do that, you see those crossbars in the wall. Okay. So the intermediate cell or intermediate filaments give the cell mechanical strength. The microfilaments, which actin is the main type of microfilament, it gives the cell some properties of elasticity and allows the cell to change its shape without breaking. Okay. So for example, all of you are sitting on your behinds, right? How big are the cells in your bottom? They're as small as any other cell is the answer, right? They're not very big. So if you sit on a little tiny glass vial, would it break underneath your rear end? Yeah, you've got enough weight that it would break some little glass vial. Well, why aren't your cells just popping all over the place? So when you stand up, you have this big mass of pop cells on your rear end. Or when I'm standing up, same thing on the bottom of my feet, right? Because there's a lot of weight there, correct, on these little tiny cells. So why aren't they popping?
Because it can change shape. They're not rigid, solid.
Yeah, they're not solid. And the thing that allows them to change shape are the microfilaments. Okay. So in that respect, we're not like a building. We're not rigid or solid, the cells. And so they can actually change shape. Now when you stand up, those cells have obviously changed shape, right? Because you have all your dead weight on your rear end. Okay. When you stand up, is your butt flat? Well, some of you have flat butts all the time, but, you know, is the cells in your butt flat? They what? They pop back out into shape, right? They kind of get circular again. And so what allows for that to happen is, again, the microfilaments. Because what the microfilaments do is they give the cell some elasticity properties. So when the cell actually changes shape, when that pressure is released from the cell, it just bounces back to its original shape. Okay. Yeah.
Does that change when you get old? Like how sometimes like old people have flat bones? Is that like?
No, that's actually not why. They lose their muscle tone there. But it does happen sometimes, and I don't know if it happens more when you get older. I'm not that old yet, but it does happen sometimes that it takes a while for your cells to bounce back out, especially if you have lots of pressure on a very small number of cells. For example, you've all fallen asleep on like a blanket, on the edge of the blanket, it's like right across your face or something. And when you get up, you have this big old red mark, and it eventually goes away in 5 or 10 minutes, but it's there for a while. And that's because those cells have been, the shape has been changed so long, it just is taking them longer to bounce back into place. Okay? Any questions about that?
Okay, so the cytoskeleton basically gives the cell shape and allows it to maintain its shape and structure. All right. Any questions about the structures in an animal cell? The next type of cell that we want to talk just a bit about are plant cells. Plant cells are a little bit different from animal cells. They're very, very similar in many respects, but they can be different. Let me just show you how they're similar here, and we can talk about them a bit. This structure right here is called a nucleus. Inside of the nucleus we have DNA, right? Kind of spaghetti-like stuff that's drawn in this picture. There's also a structure called the nucleolus, which produces ribosomes. Notice right next to the nucleus typically is a structure that looks like a series of tubes or tunnels that we call ER, right? And these the ER has tools on it. It's the workbench of the cell, and this is where proteins are produced. In addition, notice up here, what's that structure without looking at the label? The Golgi. It looks like a bunch of pita bread stacked on one another. And we know what happens in the Golgi. It's the quality control packaging center of the cell. Notice also here is a lysosome. Okay? Garbage man recycler of the cell, right? Or garbage person recycler of the cell, I should say. Notice as well, what are these organelles called? Mitochondrion. They are the power plants of the cell, right? We can tell that they're mitochondrion because they have the outer membrane and the highly folded inner membrane. Notice that it kind of depicts that there's liquid in the cell, which is what we call cytosol, right? And then there are these kind of rope-like structures. It says here they're microtubules, which are part of the cytoskeleton. So in a lot of respects, the plant cell is very, very similar to the animal cell. Functions pretty much similar in many, many ways. However, in plant cells, there are three additional structures that we don't see in animal cells. There's what we call the large vacuole, which is this big structure here. There's the cell wall, which surrounds the plasma membrane of this plant cell. And then there's an organelle here that we call chloroplast. Right? So the first thing we want to look at is we want to look at the chloroplast structure. Now, the basic function of the chloroplast is to collect sunlight energy and convert it into energy that the plant or that animals can use. So if we use our analogy of a factory, this would be almost like if a factory had its own coal-fired power plant on the factory site. What a coal-fired power plant does is it takes energy that's in coal and converts it into what? Into alternating current, right? Does that make sense to everybody? Same principle applies with the chloroplast. It takes sunlight energy, or energy that's found in sunlight, and converts it into energy that the cell can use. Does that make sense to everybody? So that's the basic function. Now, in many ways, the chloroplast is similar to mitochondria. The first thing that makes the chloroplast similar to mitochondria is chloroplasts have their own DNA. Okay? Very similar to mitochondria. So how do we get new chloroplasts in a cell? Yeah, division of pre-existing chloroplasts, just like with mitochondria. Okay. Another thing that's kind of similar is chloroplasts have essentially three membranes. They have an outer membrane, an inner membrane. It's not folded, however. Then they have kind of a third membrane inside that is really folded up, but it's folded up specifically and not just in
kind of a matrix type of a form, or it doesn't look like canyons.
What this membrane's produced or folded up like is it's folded up like a series of discs, okay? And these series of discs, or each disc, is what we call a thylakoid. Right? The word's right here, thylakoid. A series of discs, or a stack of discs, is what are called grana. Okay?
So basically, within this mitochondrion, there's a membrane, a bunch of membranes, that are in the shape of coins or discs. Okay? Each of those discs or coins are what we call a thylakoid. A stack of those coins or discs are what we call a grana. All right? Any questions about that? So, just to use another analogy, a lot of students sometimes have a hard time understanding why we would call it a grana. Just think about this. If you had a stack of 10 dimes, you wouldn't say you had a stack of 10 dimes. You would say you had a dollar, right? Does that make sense to everybody? So a stack of thylakoids is called a grana, just like a stack of 10 dimes is called a dollar. Right? Any questions? And actually, we'll talk about this in more, we'll talk about this more specifically when we talk about photosynthesis, but the thylakoids is where the sunlight energy is going to be collected, okay? And they are actually what gives the plant its green color. Typically, most plants are green. Sometimes the thylakoids give the plant a different color, but mainly it's green color. Okay. It's also fluid filled, and the fluid inside of the chloroplast is what we call the stroma. And we'll talk about the function of the stroma again more specifically when we talk about photosynthesis. But the stroma is where the energy is converted from sunlight energy into another form of energy that the cell can use. Any questions about that? Okay, so plant cells have chloroplasts. Chloroplasts are fairly easily identifiable when we look at a picture of a cell, even a drawing of a cell, because they show the stacks of thylakoids within the organelle. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. Any questions about the chloroplasts? The next two structures in the plant cell that are different from an animal cell are the cell wall and the large vacuole. Now, we didn't really talk about vacuoles in animal cells because they're somewhat insignificant. We'll talk about it here. First of all, let's talk about the cell wall. The cell wall is made up of a complex carbohydrate that we've talked about before called cellulose. Okay. Cellulose is a complex carbohydrate and it makes up all plant cell walls. Right. In fact, it's so complex that the human digestive system cannot digest it. Did you know that? So when you eat lettuce, for example, are you getting a lot of energy that's available in the lettuce out of it?
No.
You can't, because you can't digest it, essentially. And that's why they call it roughage, because you don't digest it, and it goes all the way through your digestive tract and out the other end and kind of roughs up the whole inside. Okay. You ever heard it called roughage before? Okay. But the basic function of the plant cell wall is to give the plant and the plant cell more structural support. One thing that plants don't have that many animals have is they don't have a skeleton. Right? If you think about our body, the thing that gives us structural support or strength are our bones, our skeleton, correct? Okay. Plants don't have that. If you cut a tree down, there's not a bone running up the center of the tree, correct? What it is it's just a bunch of plant cells. And those plant cells all have cellulose, or a cell wall that surrounds the plasma membrane. Okay? And that cell wall helps the plant have more structural support. Are there any questions about that? Now, one thing that I want to point out is that cell walls are not semi-permeable. We haven't used that word before. But the plasma membrane is semi-permeable. What that means is that only certain substances can cross it, or very few substances can cross a semi-permeable membrane. Does that make sense? We talked about that. They're one at the phospholipid bilayer and the polarity, the outside and inside being polar, and then the middle being non-polar, right? Okay. Cell walls are not that way. Almost, well, most substances can just pass freely across the cell wall. So it doesn't have any function in keeping things in the cell they're supposed to be in, or the things that are supposed to be out. Okay. What it does is it basically gives the cell structural support. And what you need to realize is that there is a cell wall that surrounds the plant cell, and inside of the cell wall, there is a plasma membrane that completely surrounds the cell as well. And that's really what controls what goes in and out of the cell. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. A lot of times when students take biology, they'll forget that there's a plasma membrane inside of the cell wall of the plant cell. Okay. Any questions? Now, cellulose is not really solid. It's a pretty complex molecule, and it's somewhat solid, but it's not really solid. For example, if you had a tree that just didn't have any vacuole in it, but just had plant cell walls, and what would happen is the tree would tip over, the plant would tip over, because cellulose is bendable. And that kind of makes sense. You wouldn't want to make your plant cell walls out of something that was too rigid, right? Or what would happen? It'd break when the wind blows, right? Okay, so it needs to be able to have some give in it. But what really makes the plant cell more solid and allows the plant to kind of have a skeleton because of the cell wall is this large structure right here called the large vacuole. Okay. So basically this vacuole is a water-filled structure, generally. And what happens is as the vacuole gets more and more water in it, it increases the amount of pressure inside of the cell wall. Okay? And pretty soon, the vacuole gets so full of water that the cell contents are pushed out really solidly against the cell wall, and that gives the cell wall more support. Okay? Let me give you a couple of examples. If we had a cardboard box that's, let's say, you know, that square, okay? If I were to put it on the ground here and I were to step on it, would it crush the box? Yeah, obviously, right? Easy enough answer. What if we did this, however? What if we put a balloon inside of the box and then filled the balloon with water so that water was pressing out against the side of the box? We then put that box down on the floor. Could I crush it just by standing on it? Not as easy. I might be able to stand on it for a while, right, before it collapsed, or I might have to jump on it in order to break it. That's the same principle as having the vacuole filled with water. It pushes those cell contents out against the cell wall and makes the cell wall more solid. Okay? Any questions about that? Let me give you another example that really happens in plants. Most of you have been here on campus for long enough. How many of you had moms that sent a plant with you to take to your dorm room? Nobody? Oh my gosh. Mom knew you weren't going to take care of it, right? Okay, what happens if you don't water your house plants before they die? They wilt, right? Why do plants wilt?
Because they don't have water in their vacuoles.
Yeah, they don't have their vacuoles filled with water. What happens when a plant starts to wilt is this. The plant says, I'm starving for water. I'm going to die. And so it has a big reserve of water, right? Right here in the vacuole. So what it starts to do is it starts to use the water out of the vacuole. But as it uses the water out of the vacuole, it pulls those cell contents away from the cell wall. And so the cell wall is bendable and it starts to bend. And pretty soon you have a wilted plant, right? Now if you catch that before it's too late, if it's just starting to wilt and you water it, what happens? Plant just goes right back up to where it was. It may take a little bit of time, but it does, right? And why does it do that? Because it's picking up water, putting more water in the large vacuole, which is pushing the cell contents against the cell wall. Okay? Any questions?
What about when it gets too much water, why do they die? Because they blow up?
When you give a plant too much water, you're basically smothering it. You're drowning it, essentially. Plants need oxygen to survive just like you do. Okay? You probably all heard that plants use carbon dioxide and give off oxygen. That is true, but they also use oxygen and give off carbon dioxide. So if you put plants in water, there's just not enough oxygen there for them to survive. So you basically drown them.
Or at least you ground the roots. The large vacuole, it typically, we said most of the time it's filled with water. However, there can be other substances that are stored in the large vacuole. For example, in some plants, they can store toxins in the large vacuole. Let me give you an example of this. How many of you know what morning glory is? Guess you guys have never weeded your mom's flower beds. That's the number one weed in a flower bed, if you ask me, right? When you pull up morning glory, or when you have morning glory around, you can spray it with chemicals. But generally, it does what? It just comes right back, right? And that's because morning glories are able to take that chemical herbicide you spray on it and store it in its vacuole so that it doesn't injure the cell. So some plants can do stuff like that. Any questions about the plant cell and how it's different or similar to the animal cell? Okay. The last topic that we want to talk about with cells is how do substances move across the plasma membrane? We've alluded to this before when we talked about the structure of the plasma membrane. But what I want to do is talk about how substances can move across the plasma membrane and how they do in reality move across plasma membranes. The first way in which substances can move across the plasma membrane, some substances I should say, because the plasma membrane is semi-permeable, is through a process that is known as diffusion. Diffusion is simply this. It's when molecules move from areas of high concentration to areas of low concentration. Okay. So when they move from areas of high concentration to areas of low concentration. Now diffusion occurs all over the place, not just within a cell or across the plasma membrane. Okay. For example, if I were to have a bottle of perfume up here and dump it onto the table, the perfume would be in what? Very high concentration right here on the table. And what would it want to do? It would want to diffuse, right? Okay, go from areas of higher concentration to areas of lower concentration. And pretty soon, even the folks in the back corner of the room could smell the perfume, right? And that's because, by definition, what happens in diffusion is every part of the room would need to have, if it were completely diffused, would have to have equal numbers of those perfume particles. Does that make sense? So it just kind of keeps giving them off to areas of lower concentration until everything's equaled out, like it shows in this picture here. So we start out in this picture with a beaker of water and a dye molecule. Those dye molecules go from areas of high concentration to areas of lower concentration until they're equally diffused throughout the water. Okay. Any questions? Do you guys experience this all of the time, okay, the principle of diffusion? If you can smell the person next to you, whether or not they smell good or bad, it's because of the principle of diffusion, okay? So if you put a lot of perfume or cologne or any perspirant on your body, the person next to you might be able to smell it because what's happening to that substance? It's diffusing. You haven't had a shower in a couple of days and you have a lot of body odor. That body odor is in high concentration on your body and it does what? It goes from areas of higher concentration to areas of lower concentration. So that way your neighbor can still smell you. All right? Any questions about that? Now how does diffusion work across the plasma membrane? Well, if we were to draw a plasma membrane here on the board, if a substance can diffuse across the plasma membrane, then what would happen is this. And let's say we just have some substance called X, okay? And we had two of those X's on the inside of the cell. So this is inside the cell. What if we had five of these X's on the outside of the cell? Okay. Well, what's going to happen? Well, diffusion is going to occur, right? This has a higher concentration of X than this side of the plasma membrane. So how many of these are going to diffuse across the plasma membrane?
One.
Yeah, just one, right? Oh, I did that wrong. We'll make another one up there just to make it work. Okay. So now I have six up. Yeah, six. So two of those are going to diffuse across the plasma membrane. Okay.
And that way there are equal numbers of the molecule on either side of the membrane. And that's essentially what how diffusion occurs across the plasma membrane. Yeah.
So what happened if there was an odd number?
Then it would probably bounce back and forth. And I'm trying to diffuse. Now, most substances can't move freely across the plasma membrane like this, right? And so what happens is, remember we talked about gated channel proteins in plasma membranes? This is where the gated protein channels come in. Let's say the cell needed some of this X substance. Well, all it has to do is what? Open this gate, and two of them are going to come into the cell. If it wants to have more X outside of the cell than in the cell, then it does what? Just keeps that gate closed. Does that make sense? Okay. Any questions about diffusion? The next way in which at least one substance can move across the plasma membrane, namely water, is through the process of osmosis. Osmosis is the movement of water through a selectively permeable membrane from areas of low solute concentration to areas of high solute concentration. Okay? So this is the movement of water, right? So in this particular case, let's say that this substance, whatever it is, cannot move across the plasma membrane. Okay? What's going to happen in this particular case is water is actually going to move in this direction. Out of the cell. Why? Well, the solute, whatever this substance is, there's more of it outside of the cell than in the cell, and so the water is going to move to the area where there's the highest solute concentration. Does that make sense? And the reason why it does it is so that it can diffuse that solute concentration out here, make it more diffuse outside of the cell. Okay? Now, let me give you a couple of examples of what can happen here. There are basically three types of situations that can occur in an osmotic situation. There's what we call hypotonic, hypertonic, and isotonic. Okay. In a hypotonic situation, the solute concentration is higher inside of the cell than it is outside of the cell. And so what happens? If the solute concentration is higher inside, so if we have a cell here, and the solute concentration is higher inside of the cell than out, which way is the water going to move? It's going to move into the cell, and it's going to, if it's an animal cell, it can even cause the animal cell to burst. Okay? This is how plant cells actually get water into their vacuole. Right, is by producing high solute concentrations. In a hypertonic situation, we have the cell here, and in this case, the solute concentration is higher outside of the cell than in the cell, and so the water is going to move where? Out of the cell, okay? In an isotonic situation, the solute concentration is equal inside and outside of the cell, and so which way does the water move in that case? The answer is you would say maybe it doesn't move, but it actually does. It moves in both directions equally. Okay. Any questions about that? So let me give you a couple of examples of how osmosis is very important in all organisms, or in a couple of different organisms. But before I do that, one thing I want to mention is hypertonic and hypotonic sound very similar, right? And I've actually missed the difference between them on tests before, twice. And so I had to figure out how to do this. Just stick with me real quick for a minute. The difference between hypertonic and hypotonic is this. The way I remembered it anyways, hyper kids like to go outside and play. Okay? So in a hypertonic situation, the water likes to go outside of the cell. Let me just quickly give you an example of why this is important, and we'll come back and talk about another example after the break. Have any of you ever driven to Wendover before, out across the salt flats? Okay, when you drive across the salt flats, are there any plants besides the cement one that's out in the middle there? There's no plants in the salt flats. Why? Yeah, because there's not enough water for the plants. Even if you put water on the plants, there wouldn't be enough water. And here's what's basically happening. Here you have your plants moved. Okay, here's the top of the plant. Here are the roots, and what happens is the salt concentration is very high in the salt flats. And so what happens is the water does what? It's a hypertonic situation, excuse me, the water moves out of the plant, and so the plant basically dries out. Okay? Even if you put hundreds of gallons of water on it, the plant would not survive because the solute concentration is higher outside of the cell than it is in the cell. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay, we'll see you on Wednesday.